John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013. Palestinian political prisoners continue their hunger strike, while dozens injured as Israeli troops attack protesters all over the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Clashes continued on Wednesday between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian youth protesting the death of political detainee Maisara Abu Hamdiya. Abu Hamdiya was pronounced dead on Tuesday after succumbing to an advanced case of throat cancer. Palestinian human rights group pointed Israel's army medical negligence in treating Abu Hamdiya to be the reason of his death. Today, Israeli troops used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to counter unarmed Palestinian protests organized in many West Bank cities. In Hebron Old City, southern West Bank, at least 15 youth were injured by army gunfire. 10 others were injured by Israeli troops' tear gas in the nearby Bethlehem City. 24 protesters were also treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation during protests organized near the Ofer Military Detention Center, just outside the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Meanwhile, all Palestinian political detainees continued today to refuse food in protest of Abu Hamdiya's death. According to the Palestinian Political Prisoner Society, all 4,500 Palestinian political detainees held by Israel announced a three-day hunger strike that will end on Thursday of this week. Palestinian media sources announced today that Abu Hamdiya will be laid to rest on Thursday midday in Hebron City after a medical examination by the Abu Dis University doctors. In other news, Israeli soldiers invaded several areas in occupied West Bank districts of Hebron, Bethlehem, and occupied East Jerusalem on Wednesday at dawn and kidnapped 16 Palestinians after breaking into their homes and searching them. Also on Wednesday, Israeli troops invaded the village of Tayasir near the northern West Bank city of Jenin and ransacked resident homes. According to villagers, troops searched homes and forced people out, then arrested 10 men from the village and left. In another attack, Israeli troops fired tear gas and Saab bombs at residents of Beit Umar village near Hebron city as they marched in a funeral. According to local news sources, soldiers saw the funeral from the main road and started to fire tear gas at people participating, then left the area. Many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 3rd News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Hassan Bannoura.
Afghanistan, 31st of March. Two Australian soldiers, another NATO soldier, and an Afghan soldier were wounded by an IED in Helmand Province. Two of the wounded were transported by air, indicating serious injuries. Afghanistan, 30th of March. Another NATO airstrike killed at least one child and nine suspected Taliban fighters in the eastern part of Afghanistan. This after Afghan President Karzai prohibited Afghan soldiers from calling in NATO airstrikes. A Reuters reporter reported seeing the bodies of two children, one in a school uniform. Local elder Jan Mohammed and other residents said he was killed in the airstrike. The same reporter also reported seeing the hand and foot of a toddler at the scene. Afghanistan, 3rd of April. Suicide bombers disguised as Afghan soldiers attacked a government compound, seeking to free more than a dozen Taliban prisoners being transferred to court proceedings in western Afghanistan. The mission failed, but only three of the attackers were among the at least 10 people killed. The attack began when six men wearing suicide vests drove into the center of the provincial capital of Farah province. They were in Afghan National Army vehicles that allowed them to bypass checkpoints. Two of the attackers blew themselves up inside one of the vehicles while four others jumped out of the second and ran towards the courthouse and the prosecutor's office. Guards opened fire and killed one of the attackers, while the remaining three fled to nearby buildings and opened fire in an intense gun battle. Two policemen and three civilians, including a judge and his son, also were killed. The director of public health for the province, Abdul Jabbar Sheikh, said 72 people were wounded, including 12 security forces and 60 civilians. Afghanistan, 2nd of April. Taliban gunmen attacked a local police patrol in southeastern Paktia province. Six insurgents were killed in the fighting, according to a statement from the governor's office. A roadside bomb then struck a police vehicle as it was leaving the area, killing four patrollers. Afghanistan, 2nd of April. Four police officers were killed and one was wounded when their vehicle hit a roadside bomb in northeastern Kunar province during an operation to clear the area of other bombs. Pakistan, 1st of April. Unknown militants burned five containers carrying NATO supplies back out of Afghanistan to Port Qasim, Karachi, as they passed through Balochistan's Bolan district on Monday. Four fighters on motorcycles opened fire on the containers, chasing the drivers away unharmed. Then they burned the cargo containers. Afghanistan, 30th of March. A suicide bomber blew up a police patrol in northwestern Pakistan, killing a policeman and wounding six others, according to police. The bombing took place at a market in Katalang, 50 kilometers northeast of Peshawar. Four civilians were also wounded in the suicide bombing, according to senior police official Shafiullah. After the bombing, police chased an alleged handler of the suicide bomber and killed him in a shootout. Mr. Barack Obama, this so-called war on terror goes on and on with no end in sight. Bring all the troops home from all the battlefields and ground all the drones today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. In occupied Canada, there is a government plan to begin massive industrial activity centering on oil, gas, mineral, and hydroelectric power generation in the northern parts of the country. All of this is largely undamaged First Nations land, yet the Canadian government plans to dig up, dam, poison, and destroy it. It will kill the land, kill the animals, and kill the people who live there if they are not stopped. During March, defenders of Northern Turtle Island placed posters on a major highway project that is part of Plan Nord, claiming that landmines have been planted along the route. On the 29th of March, this communique was posted to www.anarchistnews.org. I will read only the English version as I do not read French. Quote, "Fuck the Plan Nord. During the month of March, a poster was placed at the entrance to the Phase A section of the Highway 167 development project that will lead to the Renard project and the Stornoway diamond mine. The poster reads, "Attention, mining anti-personnel, Sur les prochaines 10 kilometers. Danger, explosive mines in the next 10 kilometers." During the same night, the Soquim office in the city of Chibougamau was vandalized. The facade of the building was completely covered in paint by an extinguisher, including all the cameras. A window was smashed with a hammer, and graffiti written saying, "Fuck Le Plan Nord." Soquim is one of the more active partners in the Renard project. Soquim and his partners currently finance more than $10 million worth of exploration in Quebec. Fuck Le Plan Nord and all mining companies. Let's continue the attacks, some anarchists. Of April, a video appeared on Ustream showing Rising Tide Seattle activists inside an unknown office building lobby that they had stormed. They were there to protest the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. I'm guessing the building was some kind of Canadian consulate, as speeches given referred to Canada, but not to any corporation involved in the pipeline. While speaking, activists poured water or what appeared to be water from a clear bottle onto a banner or rug visible on the floor. Here's what things sounded like.
No pipelines,
no tar sands,
we will blockade.
No pipeline,
no tar sands,
we will blockade.
Okay, I'm going to read the manifesto of why we're here. I'm going to read the manifesto. We are a group of Seattle area residents who are outraged that the Harper government is turning Canada into a rogue nation that poses a threat on a planetary scale. In its utter disregard for environmental protections and First Nations rights, in its determination to expand Alberta's tar sands operation, despite the devastating consequences, in the vast expansion of Canadian mining operations all over the world in the last 7 years, and in its servile attentions to fossil fuel and mining interests, the Harper government has turned Canada's fine international and environmental reputation upside down. We know that the U.S. does not stand on higher moral ground. Quite the contrary. For more than half a century, the U.S. has followed policies with devastating effects on the world's land, waters, and peoples. That is undeniable, and we will continue to work to change that. But the sins of our own government do not mean we must remain silent regarding the sins of another. Given the current state of the climate crisis we're in, the continued erosion of indigenous rights, the high degree of environmental injustice, the breakdown of communities and colleges, and the destruction of the few remaining natural habitats around the world, with the benefit of corporate and banking interests, we cannot and we not, will not allow the expansion of the tar sands.
Kinder Morgan and Keystone XL pipelines. Canada must keep the tar sands in the ground so that no more of the boreal forest is clear-cut, nor its waters poisoned, but the health, livelihood, and sacred lands of First Nations can begin to recover.
Thank you very much.
So that the humanity retains
no worries.
chances to avoid catastrophic climate change, so that there is less demand for fracking both in Canada and the USA.
Fair enough. There's a lot going on right now.
So this group here, with which group
of so
it's a group of individuals. There's no name for this group.
They're not suffering the devastating effects.
You got people.
You heard that, Canada. People don't want your toxic tar sands pipeline. On the 1st of April, WTOP Radio and Fox News broadcast reports that the National Park Service killed only 20 deer from March 28th to March 30th in their failed deer removal operation in Rock Creek Park. They also say they will not try again this year. One wounded deer was also found near 16th Street and Floral after residents heard shots late night on the 28th of March. The Rock Creek Park deer killing operation was announced by surprise on the 27th of March, with unclear reports of whether the National Park Service's contract killers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture would shoot days over 3 days or four, in either case to be finished on the 30th of March by 4 a.m. The Park Service announced most roads in Rock Creek Park would be closed for at least for the 3 days of the 28th, the 29th, and the 30th of March as the snipers shot at the deer. The Park Service at first said they wanted to kill 132 deer out of an estimated population of 300, later revised downward to 60 deer sentenced to death. It didn't quite work out that way. Beginning on the 27th of March, compassionate people who care about animals deployed to the intersection of Military Road and Oregon Avenue bordering the park. Over the next 4 days, they shut the deer killers down so completely that only 20 deer were killed, still 20 too many according to activists. On the 27th of March, there was no sign of park rangers or the USDA snipers, and the roads remained open. On the 28th of March, police were told no guarantee could be offered that there were not more protesters in the woods waiting to disrupt the shooters. Protesters noticed a large number of police vehicles and park rangers, and the roads were closed at 10 p.m. as scheduled. Then the shooters made a critical mistake. One of them pointed his laser-sighted weapon at a protester.
Did you put a laser dot on your chest?
Yes. A moment ago, and I was oriented this way, so it was likely coming
from came then from somebody in those woods, somebody in that cop car, or somebody in one of the three vehicles there. Standing here, I have line of sight to that entire position. It probably came from one of the riflemen who would probably be positioned somewhere around that hilltop. There's two of the thugs right there.
That night, 20 deer were killed and one was wounded, found later by neighbors around 16th Street and Floral. The following two nights, protesters never saw a single sign of the USDA's so-called hunters. Protests grew in size and intensity, and on the other hand, the roads remained open. On Saturday night, protesters stayed on site all the way to the 4 a.m. deadline for reopening roads, but the roads never closed. At least one protester showed himself to the police from the woods, and teams of activists cruised to still open park roads and cars. The hunters became the hunted as animal rights activists scoured the park for any sign of the USDA's contract killers or the massive buffer zones they required. Nothing was ever found, and protesters finally packed it in at 4 a.m. on Easter morning. Nearly 2 days later, the National Park Service told the media they had killed only 20 deer, the same number they earlier had said they killed on the first night. On the last night, a park police officer claimed 44 more had been killed the second night, presumably after protesters quit at around midnight, but the Monday afternoon statements given to the press contained the report that only 20 deer were ever killed. That cop evidently was lying, hoping protesters would give up so USDA kill teams could deploy.
Hey, Rock Creek Park! How many deer did you kill in the dark?
It appears that the incident with the laser-sighted weapon being aimed at a protester, the reports of protesters in the woods, were both
caused either USDA to prohibit their snipers from setting up again with protesters on site, the Park Service to prohibit them from doing so, or both. As a result, DC area animal rights activists are entitled to credit for shutting down the deer slaughter 2 out of the planned 3 days. Not only that, the Park Service appears to have given up on plans to kill deer in fall 2013 as well, conceding that the issue is just too hot to handle. The hypocrisy of this plan was beyond belief. There are 500,000 people in DC, and the Park Service was saying 300 deer are too many. They were going to send so-called hunters who don't finish off those that they mortally wound and never eat what they kill against deer, while doing nothing about the cars that have overrun the park and the development choking the life out of it.
As the nations of the European Union continue to pursue austerity policies to address the continent's ongoing economic crisis, the news is not good. The EU's unemployment rate rose in January to 26.2 million people, or 10.8% of the working-age population. Youth unemployment increased to a record level of 23.6%, with nearly 60% jobless in both Greece and Spain. In another grim indicator, the gross domestic product across the EU contracted by 0.5%, the worst decline since 2009. Now, an EU-engineered bailout of the Cyprus banking system has created a new crisis of confidence among people across Europe. Cyprus, with a banking industry over 5 times larger than the nation's annual GDP, attracted billions of euros from overseas due to its low tax rates, especially from Russia's oligarchs and wealthy class. Now, as part of a $13 billion bailout deal made with the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and EU, collectively known as the Troika, the nation's second-largest bank will be closed, and severe limits have been placed on withdrawals from all Cypriot banks. But the bailout condition that has caused the most public anger and unease across the EU is the decision to tax a reported 30-40% of funds from depositor accounts of more than 100,000 euros in Cypriot banks, leading to fears of similar confiscations in other Eurozone nations. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Brown, chairperson and president of the Public Banking Institute and author of the book Web of Debt. Here, Brown explains why she believes that the European Union's confiscation of depositor funds in Cyprus could serve as a template for future confiscation of funds deposited in U.S. and British banks.
Well, they have two bankrupt banks, which interestingly were declared quite solvent or not, or they passed the stress test like 2 weeks before they were declared hopelessly bankrupt. And in order to, they needed a loan from the Troika, the IMF, ECB, EC, and in order to get it, they were told that they had to do a tax on the depositors in those banks, including the insured depositors. Well, the people took to the streets and protested and said no way were they going to approve taking the deposits of the bank to bail out the bank. And so that the solution they came to was that the insured depositors didn't have to pay, the ones with under 100,000 euros in the bank, but the ones over that had to pay a very sizable haircut, as it's called, 40%. And now they're talking it could go as high as 80%. I mean, they're virtually going to confiscate this money. Much of it is Russian oligarchs and tax haven people and so forth, people you're not too sympathetic with. But they're also, their businesses are there. European businesses have their money there. And what if you have a business? Right now, even the insured depositors, nobody can get more than 300 euros out per day. What if you have to run a business and you have to pay your workers out of your bank account? So it's really quite alarming, and it was sort of billed at first as a one-off, well, this is an emergency, and that was just a special case. But as you look around the world, it really isn't. It's called bail-in, where you go after the creditors of the bank itself. Basically, what we've come to is that governments have said, we're not going to bail out the big banks anymore. Right, we have the Dodd-Frank bill, which says the big, too big to fail banks can continue to gamble in derivatives, but that the taxpayers are not going to bail them out in the event of a major derivatives fiasco. And so recent hearings have revealed that they're actually commingling funds, and they're allowed to do it, I guess. So they've got the derivatives are in the same branch as the deposits. Well, for example, J.P. Morgan has over $1 trillion in deposits, and they have $79 trillion in derivatives, which is more than the gross domestic product of the whole world, just in derivatives. And that, I mean, that's just J.P. Morgan. So if they had a big derivatives crisis, the government is not going to help. Even if they wanted to, FDIC insurance only has $25 billion in the fund, and there's something like $9 trillion in deposits in the whole country. So they clearly don't have enough in the fund for a big crisis. So what all these plans are for, they seem to have emanated from the G20 Financial Stability Board, which the 20 nations signed on to in 2009 as a sort of global regulator of our banks. They're the ones that told all these countries that they have to set up some sort of bail-in provisions, which are provisions where you go after your own creditors. Well, what people don't realize is that we are creditors of the bank. As soon as you put your money in the bank, it becomes the money of the bank, and we become creditors. All we have is an IOU. We used to be insured creditors, but now we can see from what's happening in Cyprus that we can't count on that anymore.
Ellen, most people who deposit money in banks here in the United States are fairly assured for many years that the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, was to insure that money. If the bank went belly up, that they would get their money out. If what's the limit, $250,000 or less?
Right.
So what are the loopholes that would allow the government, the bank, or whoever to confiscate your money if you're within the confines of the FDIC insurance agreement?
Well, it's just that they don't have enough money in the fund. And what would happen if there was a big derivatives bust that was bigger than that? They've required the big banks to do these, they're called living wills, where they set out what they would do, how they would save themselves in the event of a big crisis, because under Dodd-Frank, they've been told, the government, don't count on the government. We're not going to fix your derivatives losses for you. So then they've come up with these plans, and I saw the J.P. Morgan one, and it says there's this FDIC Bank of England directive that says they will take the money of the unsecured creditors and turn it into stock. So basically, it's a debt for equity swap. They have a debt to us, as we're considered unsecured creditors. And what they'll give us instead is bank stock. But it's bank stock in what could well be a bankrupt bank if you look at Lehman Brothers or whatever. So they've totally changed the rules of the game, which means you can't tell what could happen. In the FDIC Bank of England directive, it doesn't say anything about insured deposits being excluded. It doesn't even mention them. So it seems to me intentionally vague. I mean, the whole thing is vague. It's hard to read. But it seems to me that they're setting us up for, you know, this is kind of a warning, like, be prepared, this could happen here, because we don't know what's coming down, and if there's another big black swan event, they could hit the depositors.
That was Ellen Brown, an attorney and president of the Public Banking Institute. She's the author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. Find links to Brown's recent articles, including the confiscation scheme planned for U.S. and U.K. depositors, on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In two landmark cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, the future of same-sex marriage hangs in the balance. Although the high court rulings in these cases will determine the shape of marriage law in the U.S. in the short term, it seems inevitable that with a dramatic shift in Americans' attitudes moving toward approval of gay marriage, the nation will eventually realize full marriage equality. The first of two cases being considered involved a challenge to California's Proposition 8 ban on gay marriage that was approved by voters in 2008, overturning a ruling legalizing same-sex marriage handed down earlier by California's Supreme Court. The second case heard by the justices contests the constitutionality of the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, that defines marriage as between a man and a woman, banning federal recognition of same-sex marriage, and effectively denying tax, Social Security, and other ordinary benefits to gay couples. Many legal observers who assessed the justices' interaction with and questions to attorneys in the two cases predicted the court's rulings, expected this June, would likely usher in incremental change rather than a broad decision mandating the legalization of marriage equality in all 50 states. Your reporter spoke with Thalia Zapatos, Director of Public Engagement with the group Freedom to Marry, who examines the historic nature and possible outcomes of the same-sex marriage cases now before the Supreme Court.
You know, both cases before the court last week were fundamentally about whether gay and lesbian Americans should have the same freedoms and protections as everyone else in our country. You know, I think all couples find someone they want to marry and share their hopes and dreams with, and they marry to be there for one another and protect each other, you know, in good times and in bad. And so, you know, what's at stake in these two cases are a number of different pieces. One is very specifically in terms of the DOMA case, is literally whether same-sex couples will be penalized at the federal level, both economically and in a sort of moral sense, for being legally married in their own state. In the California case, similarly, you know, that 18,000 couples were able to get married when marriage was legal there, and then a big door was shut. And so we have now additional couples in California who are seeking the opportunity to marry and care for the person they love. And as Justice Kennedy pointed out in his comments, also 30,000 children being raised by same-sex couples in California who come home from school and ask their parents why they can't be married too, or why they can't be a real family.
In terms of the various scenarios that we can guess at of what the Supreme Court will decide here, what's the best case scenario for your organization and the worst case scenario? And maybe we can also just briefly discuss some of the state-by-state strategies that I know you've all been thinking about for quite some time.
Yeah, certainly. Well, the best case scenario for us would be first overturning DOMA so that those couples that are legally married, you know, currently in nine states plus the District of Columbia, will be eligible for the same level of federal protections and responsibilities as well, that they will file their federal taxes jointly and not be forced to file singly, for example. So that would be a tremendous benefit to those families as well as military families. I mean, there's a lot of gray area now and, you know, very difficult situations that active duty military who are married have where, you know, their spouse or children are not allowed to live in married family housing, etc. So overturning DOMA would clarify a lot of that and really open the doors to those couples who are legally married in that list of states. The best scenario in the Perry case is certainly the broadest possible scenario would be a 50-state decision that would say that, you know, there's no reason to discriminate against same-sex couples in any state, and that the Supreme Court finds that, you know, equal protection under the law includes equal rights to marriage. So that would be the broadest. The narrowest would be potentially rejecting the Perry case on standing or, you know, agreeing with the Ninth Circuit Court, which would legalize marriage once again in California. And then there's an in-between scenario that the Department of Justice laid out in their brief and made the case for, which was that states that offer all of the same legal protections, either calling it civil union or domestic partnership, that's another eight or nine states right now, that those states should just simply be reviewed and potentially be considered states where marriage would also be quickly become legal for same-sex couples. That's a little less certain, and the path to that, you know, depending on how the decision is written, would be a little less clear. But in any event, it seems clear to us that we've got work to do, you know, going back to the states, and whether it's just public education work or actually running additional campaigns and persuading state by state to support marriage for same-sex couples, you know, we feel we've got some work set out for us in the next couple of years.
I did want to ask you about the importance of other battles here in terms of equality. I've heard from some, not a lot, but there are some critics out there who say instead of marriage being the priority issue for the LGBT community, it really should be the issue of employment discrimination. How do you see the relative importance of marriage equality and discrimination at the workplace, which has not been addressed to many people's satisfaction?
That's a great question, Scott. Sometimes I've, you know, been in conversations with voters who say, you know, why is it the gay community keeps bringing this up?
But part of it is that anti-gay forces keep bringing it up. And I think they've grabbed on marriage as a sort of social issue that they can generate a lot more anxiety around, and that has, in some ways, propelled marriage forward. I think the good news for the whole movement is, once we get people thinking about who gay and lesbian people are, you know, why same-sex couples are more similar than different from themselves, that as we kind of break down these barriers, that flows into employment non-discrimination and issues around gender identity as well. So it's a kind of, you know, closing the gap and helping people see that there are fewer differences and more similarities. And I think that will spill over very, very quickly to employment non-discrimination as well. I mean, once we have same-sex couples getting married in more states, our biggest problem on employment sometimes is that people assume that those protections are already in place. They're often very shocked if they live in a state that has no employment non-discrimination protection and are very, very willing and supportive to see that get passed.
That was Thalia Zapatos, Director of Public Engagement with the group Freedom to Marry. Learn more about the ongoing campaign of the marriage equality movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.